It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Friday on Current State means live music here in Studio S, Live Music Friday. And we are happy to welcome back to the program Brendan Doherty of East Lansing, an Irish singer, songwriter, guitarist with a new CD out, Feels Like Home. We're going to open the show with an original of Brendan's, Dacia Town, The Ballad of Thomas Francis Mayer.
From Dacia Town to the River Missouri, they put me down, no judge, no jury. On a bright blue day, when the birds sang sweetly, I found my peace in the River Missouri. I led the cause, tricolor flying. I had no fear, no fear of dying. And so for treason they tried me. A rifle shot would set me free. Van Diemen's land is where they sent me. A faith worse than death, oh heaven mend me. For the land I love is a world away. Ne'er again I'll see a bright blue day. A bright blue day. Chance to escape, then came a calling on a whaling boat for New York calling, and a hero's welcome there met me. A second chance for Ireland's free. My countrymen, they rallied round me, and in 61. They fought so bravely to find the Union as we know. Then to Montana I did go. Well, this merchant's son who hailed from Ireland, he held his dream for his island. He dreamed one day it could be that bright blue day he'd never see. From Dacia Town to the River Missouri, they put me down, no judge, no jury. On a bright blue day, when the birds sang sweetly, I found my peace in the River Missouri. River Missouri, in the River Missouri.
Dacia Town, the Ballad of Thomas Francis Mayer, an original composition by our Live Music Friday special guest, Brendan Doherty, who returns to Current State. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but that sounds like the story of an Irishman who came to America.
Correct.
And it's all true? It's based on, there really was a Thomas Francis
Mayer?
There really was.
Yeah, and he comes from the same city I do.
Okay.
Waterford in the southeast.
A favorite son.
Yes, absolutely.
Of Waterford, at least. Is that it?
Yeah, and he designed the tricolor. So quite a famous son.
Okay.
Yeah.
And everybody who grows up in Waterford knows the story of Thomas Francis Mayer, I take
starting it. Starting to now. Yeah, he disappeared in history for a while, and He's kind of, there's a big revival going on at the moment, so.
How interesting.
Yeah, and he wound up governor of Montana in the end.
Yeah. The governor of Montana?
Yeah, first governor. Before,
no kidding.
I think just before they joined the union, he was a lawyer. So he wrote the first constitution for Montana.
How fascinating. How very interesting. Yeah. So he served as governor of Montana about when? That had been late 19th century?
Immediately after the Civil War.
Immediately after the Civil War. Okay,
yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, more music and probably more history coming up with Brendan Doherty, who has returned to Current States Live Music Friday. More music, more conversation with Brendan coming up in just a little bit. I'm Mark Bayshore. If Hillary Clinton is elected president in November, a very familiar figure from Michigan will be part of her move to the White House.
Our next president knows that a nation is a village, that we are one family, and in a family, no one gets left behind.
Former Governor Jennifer Granholm, heard there at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, has been a Clinton supporter in this campaign, and she's been tapped to serve as a member of the candidate's transition team if she wins in November. Granholm's been a two-term governor and state attorney general. Today she teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and advises the Clinton campaign. Yesterday, Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Jennifer Granholm about Hillary Clinton and the 2016 campaign. He first asked about the Democratic primary campaign and the impact Bernie Sanders' candidacy had on the process.
Oh, I think it was a very positive impact on the overall outcome and the platform on the Democratic Party. You know, Bernie Sanders, I think, was such a strong and forceful voice about, for example, student debt and college affordability, and the platform language and the language that Hillary Clinton has now placed into her own policies regarding that is terrific. He obviously really made income inequality the signature issue of the primary, and that has been really important in how she has striven to pay for the policies that she's putting forward. For example, using the tax structure to make sure that the wealthy are paying their fair share so that we can afford making sure that kids can go to college or making sure that we've got investments in job creation or in job training. So I think he had a tremendous impact on what will happen going forward, and he'll continue to do that, obviously, with his voice in the Senate.
When you look at when you look back at the DNC and how Debbie Wasserman Schultz was handling things, the implication that there was a pro-Clinton bias at the DNC, how do you regard that, and how do you think it played out? What impact do you think it has now on the campaign?
I don't think it has an impact now on the campaign. I think that was obviously all lead up to the convention. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that she's a friend of mine. So I felt very badly that she was, that she had to go. Although I completely understand the perception issues, and I think that Donna Brazile is fantastic, and I'm glad that she's taking the interim job. But Debbie, she was a fierce fighter for Democratic priorities. And I'm glad that the storm has died down and that she has moved on, and I hope she's able to win her election.
All right, there are other storms, and we'll get to them. But I want to move on to the Clinton-Trump campaign season now. And one thing I wanted to make sure we spent a little time on is the mention on your website that you're serving as an advisor on energy to the Clinton team. Can you tell me what exactly that means? What are you advising her on?
Yeah, the policy teams that the Clinton Foundation put together obviously included people who had experience in substantive areas. And so I, along with Carol Browner, was the co-chair of the Energy and Climate Task Force. And so what we, underneath the policies that you see appearing on her website, was a lot of work, a whole big working group that went into putting those policies together. So, for example, when she says she wants to see 500 million solar panels deployed in homes across America. That came from that policy group when she talks about this clean energy challenge to the governors, a $60 billion challenge to get the states to really up their game in terms of their renewable portfolio standards and the percentage of energy that they get from clean renewable sources. That was from the work of this policy group. So the policy groups now have sort of wound down because all of the policies have been developed and are on the websites. But the work goes on in terms of planning for the transition and for, you know, if she's elected, the first 100 days. So I'm also one of the co-chairs of her transition team. And that that work about how to take the policies that have been actually put on the website and make them reality is about to begin, and will begin really in earnest after the election.
You brought up the transition team. What exactly does that mean? What does a transition team do, and when does it do it?
Yeah, well, for any candidate who is in the general election, and this is true with the Trump campaign as well, there has to be a lot of work that goes into making sure that there's a successful launch of the candidate should they be elected. And with these candidates, so for example, Chris Christie was named as the chair of Trump's transition team back in May. So there's especially if you're taking over from another party, there's just a lot of work that goes into making sure that you've done an agency review, you've identified people who could take positions, you plan for how to make sure their promises become reality. But with the Clinton team, I can just speak to that from personal knowledge. It's a very small team to begin with because you want people to be focused on the main thing, which is getting her elected, but you still have to think through how you are going to be planning to launch her. And so that preliminary work has begun with a very small group, and it's based out of Washington, D.C.
It sounds like there would be a lot of work between Election Day and Inauguration
Yes.
Day. Would there be work after Inauguration Day?
No. Usually after Inauguration Day, then that work, you know, they hand over the binders full of policies, et cetera, to the people who will be assuming these positions and getting confirmed into the agencies. So once she's inaugurated, then there's a handoff.
We're talking with Governor Jennifer Granholm, who's on Hillary Clinton's transition team. I wanted to ask you about the current status of polls about the race, which routinely, of late anyway, are showing Hillary Clinton with sizable leads, not just nationwide, but in some cases in some states where it's a bit of a surprise maybe that a Democrat is leading in the polls. What are your observations about the current polling?
Well, I think it's reflecting reality in the sense that there is just such a huge question mark and animosity about Donald Trump. I mean, both sides have their challenges, but the thrust of his campaign, and you'll hear this more today even from Hillary Clinton talking about the divisive nature of his campaign and who he has embraced and given life to. For example, this alt-right, far conservative right wing, which is a white nationalist movement that has basically embraced and endorsed him. That, you know, her hope, I think, in raising this is that, you know, sunshine is the greatest disinfectant, and hopefully people will understand what's really going on underneath the surface. The fact that he brought in this fellow Steve Bannon from Breitbart News, and Bannon has been associated with these groups and has run this, you know, this news organization, Breitbart, that has people on and contributing to it that are clearly with this very dark racist strain that is certainly not the majority of the Republican Party, but there is this wing that he has empowered. And that, I think, is you're seeing some of that percolate up. People aren't comfortable with that. And so even in states that are very conservative, you're seeing a discomfort. I think it's one of the reasons why he's going to Mississippi, and he's going to North Carolina, and he's coming to Michigan, and he's talking about an outreach to the African-American community. I'm not sure whether that's legit. I don't think it is. I think what he's legitimately trying to do is to, you know, to tamp down the concerns of moderate Republicans and suburban Republicans who are uncomfortable with the notion that so many white nationalists are embracing the Trump campaign.
A federal judge has ordered the State Department to speed up a review of about 15,000 previously undisclosed emails that the FBI has retrieved from Hillary Clinton's server. As a supporter, are you worried about what might be in those emails?
No, I'm not. I think that those emails are largely probably duplicative of what's already out there, or they're the private emails that she didn't turn over because they were private. So he's going to review, the State Department will review those and determine what is public information and what's not. But you've seen, the 60,000 pages already that have been reviewed. The FBI has reviewed them. They already had them, those 15,000. They have reviewed them. I don't think there's anything in them of note.
What are your observations about the disclosures regarding supporters of the Clinton Foundation and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and access to her during the time that she was Secretary of State? Does any of that concern you these days?
Well, this infuriates me in many ways. I mean, first of all, this comes from a study that the AP did where they pulled out for half of her term, for 2 years of her term, they pulled out only the meetings that she had with people who were non-governmental entities. And it is true that some of them, half of them or whatever, had donated to the foundation. But the question really is, what was the purpose of meeting with them? Was the purpose of meeting with them, which is what the folks on the Trump team have indicated or suggested, the purpose of meeting with them was because they were donors to the foundation. So did she meet with Melinda Gates because Melinda Gates had donated the foundation, or did she meet with Melinda Gates because the Gates Foundation is doing a huge amount of work with the State Department on health initiatives globally? It's the latter. Did she meet with Elie Wiesel, Nobel Prize-winning Elie Wiesel, whose foundation donated to the Clinton Foundation because he donated to the Clinton Foundation, or because Elie Wiesel was, obviously he's passed now, was doing great humanitarian service across the globe? Did she meet with this fellow, Muhammad Yunus, who was a Nobel Prize winner, who got the Medal of Freedom from President Obama, who was working to eradicate global poverty and was an expert in microfinance because his foundation happened to donate to the Clinton Foundation, or because he was actually doing huge work that the State Department was doing and they needed these public-private partnerships or the partnerships with these global philanthropies to carry on the work of the State Department? So the bottom line is, a lot of these global charities that are doing great work are partnering with the State Foundation, with the state of the State Department, to make sure that AIDS is eradicated, that malaria drugs are available, that child poverty is eradicated, that young women in Southern Africa are not abused. All of these meetings, those kind of meetings, might be with people who run foundations who happen to also do work with the Clinton Foundation. But does that mean that that's why they got access? And by the way, that story indicated there was nothing improper about those meetings. These are all people that any Secretary of State would have met with. And my guess is probably Colin Powell and Madeleine Albright met with similar heads of charities and individuals who are doing work globally that the State Department was working with.
We've been talking with Governor Jennifer Granholm about her role on Hillary Clinton's transition team. Thank you for joining us on Current State.
All right. Thanks so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
I'm Mark Bayshore. This is 90.5 WKAR and a live music Friday here on Current State. Brendan Doherty grew up in Waterford, Ireland. These days he calls East Lansing home, and he is our featured performer on Live Music Friday. Here's Brendan performing The Homes of Donegal.
Just stepped in to see you all. I'll only stay a while. I want to see how you're getting on. I want to see you smile. I'm happy to be here once more and greet you tall and small. There's no place else on earth that's like the homes of Donegal. see the happy faces smiling at the door. The kettle swinging on the crook as I step up to the floor. And soon the teapot's filling up me cup that's far from small. For your hearts are like your mountains in the homes of Donegal. I long to sit a while with you beside your campfire bright. Tales of yore and fairy lore beside your turf fire bright. And then to see you prepare for me a shakedown by the wall. For there's no place else on earth that's like the homes of Donegal. Donegal, pride of all.
Brendan Doherty there, performing live in Studio S. Brendan's new CD is called Feels Like Home. That's Homes of Donegal, track number 4 on the new CD. He sings and plays equally well, and earlier in the hour we heard one of his original compositions. More music and conversation with Brendan Doherty on the way here on a Live Music Friday. Well, the start of the fall semester here at Michigan State University is just a few days away. An estimated 50,000 students are enrolled at MSU this fall, and that means move-in weekend, which is coming up. MSU housing officials have been getting ready for the big move. Here to talk with us about it is Dr. Ray Gasser. Ray's the Interim Director for Residence Education and Housing Services at MSU. Welcome, Ray.
Good morning.
And also with us, Annika Hart, an engineering major at MSU and a returning resident assistant and RA to Case Hall. Hi, Annika.
Hi.
Ray, as we said, total enrollment around 50,000. Of that number, how many people live on campus?
We have about 15,500, roughly, that live on campus.
Okay. And from your perspective, what's logistically most challenging about fall move-in for you?
The biggest challenge really has to do with elevators on Sunday. That's when first-year students arrive onto campus. Our staff do a wonderful job getting stuff out of cars and people checked in and keys and whatnot. Our limitation is our number of elevators. So we try to encourage families to kind of stagger over the course of the day, so we give them different arrival times.
I imagine one elevator breakdown could hang up quite a lot.
It absolutely does.
Has that happened?
It has. It has.
Does it typically happen once during move-in weekend?
You know, for the last couple years, we haven't had any, but that's where we have a lot of volunteers that, if we need to, we'll start carrying stuff upstairs for you.
See, one of my later questions was, what wakes you up before the alarm goes off in the morning when move-in weekend comes in? It sounds like it might be a broken elevator.
It would be. It would be.
What else is on your short list of priorities here this week, let's say?
You know, we just really want to make sure that every student gets in and starts to get adjusted. There are students out there that those initial jitters and feeling a little bit homesick. We find that if we find a way to connect them to something, someone, some group on campus, they have a lot more. There's research that shows that they can be successful here at Michigan State if we just find a way to connect them to a group or a person.
Understood. And Annika, that's a role that you figure into as well as a returning RA.
Absolutely.
To Case Hall. How do you view your role? What do you think is the most important part of your job?
I think the most important part of my job is just to be the first face that residents see when they come in, make sure that they feel welcome, make sure that they know that they should be here and there's a community here for them, and I'm here to assist them to find that community.
And you kind of need to, as an RA, I know you have to try to bond with everybody, which sounds really potentially rewarding, but also kind of stressful. How does that play out?
Yeah, for sure. It can definitely be stressful. You know, some residents come to you and they tell you everything, and you have other residents who you see a couple times a year, but it's knowing that if they ever came to you for anything, you would be there for mm-hmm. them, and mm-hmm. that you're always available regardless of their relationship with you.
How many students are on your floor?
I have about 42 this year, I think.
Why did you want to become an RA?
I actually wanted to become an RA when my sister moved in. I was 10 years old, and I saw door decks, and I said, I want to make those. And ever since then...
What are those?
Okay, they're your name tag that goes on your door. So each RA for every floor can be as creative or as non-creative as they want to be and decorate them, and it just has your name so you know that when you walk into that room, that's your home.
And your 10-year-old self saw those, all that color and all that creativity, yep. and said... I want to be able to do that, so I'm going to become an RA.
Exactly.
What are you studying?
I'm studying environmental engineering here at Michigan State.
Okay, very good. So you spend a lot of time across the street.
I do, yeah. in the engineering building.
Ray Gasser, MSU, has built a new housing complex called 1855 Place. This is on the former state police site near Harrison and Kalamazoo. Describe for us what's happened there.
So we just opened up three of the buildings. It's still under construction, the rest of the property. The three buildings are family units. So we have almost 190 apartments, 1- and 2-bedroom apartments for families, student families that live at Michigan State, attend Michigan State, to be able to live there.
Mm-hmm. And so, this was built to replace Spartan Village, correct?
It was. So at the end of this academic year, we will be closing Spartan Village to students on campus, and we'll be able to open the second phase of 1855 Place, which adds about another 600 beds to the campus. And that's really for single students. Both townhouses, 1, 2, and 4-bedroom apartments.
We're talking about the start of the fall semester here at Michigan State University. Move-in officially starts on campus this weekend. Dr. Ray Gasser is the Interim Director of Residence Education and Housing Services, and Annika Hart is an RA, a resident assistant who's majoring in environmental engineering at MSU. Certainly going to college is an emotional transition for an incoming freshman. We've talked about that a little bit, and some acclimate better than others. We wanted to get a little perspective on the move from one of those students who's just starting here at MSU. We spoke with Morgan Pohl, who plans to major in theater. Full disclosure here, Morgan's the daughter of current state producer Scott Pohl. We asked Morgan what this experience feels like.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I've always been pretty independent, but it's nice to be close enough that if I do need something, then my family is only half an hour away, or in the case of my dad, right in the same building as where I work. But I'll be living on my own, so I'll be able to do more things for myself, which is really nice. I guess one thing about moving in is that we, from what I can tell, only get a 20-minute parking pass to bring all of our things up to our room, so that will be difficult. And also, the times for moving in are staggered, and I'm not moving in at the same time as my roommate, so she won't be there for me to discuss with her how we're going to set everything up.
So Morgan Pohl there, an incoming freshman at MSU, she talked about that 20-minute window, which sounds kind of stressful. How does that impact you? How do you connect with that, Ray?
Well, and I want to be completely honest. If you need 30 minutes, or if you're still unpacking your vehicle, they're not going to ticket you. But it's,
if you can get it done in 20 minutes, so much the better. Is that the idea?
Exactly. Yeah. Because we know on Sunday, on that big move-in day, we'll have about 5,400 students check in on that day alone. On that day, we just want to make sure that the parking lot's closest to the halls, those spaces close to the halls. We get the cars moved out to parking lots away from the halls. So that's why it's the 20-minute.
Does Morgan sound like a lot of the incoming freshmen you've worked
Absolutely.
With, Annika?
Yep, they're always nervous about the parking, but I assure them that it goes pretty quick.
Yeah. What year are you in?
I'm a junior.
Junior. International students have already moved in on campus. Talk about that transition, Ray.
Yeah, that's a good question, because we have over 1,000 international students that arrived last Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, for them, there's not the hustle and bustle at campus because not everyone else is here. And so they go through their own orientation. And so they're spending the week going through orientation on campus right now. But they're really looking forward to being able to connect with some domestic students and start really their Spartan experience.
Ray, there's so much that's been written recently, and Michigan State has figured in this too. I mean, living in a campus dorm, is just a whole lot richer experience, I think, than it used to be. The amenities, the food. I mean, I'm flashing on Brody on the Brody cafeteria here, and all of the dining options just there. But there are other ones as well. Is this a trend you see continuing? And how do you see it? How do you see on-campus living changing and improving here in the near future?
You know, the one thing that I would agree with you on all those sentiments about the food and the amenities, but I think what's more important is the experience, the community, just the connection that the students will get by living on campus. I mean, we've got staff on every floor taking care to make sure that if a student has a question, if they're lost, if they're just feeling disconnected, we're there for them. And you wouldn't find that off campus. So that's really the difference that we're trying to go for.
Well, I know part of the reason behind these engagement centers has been to develop a sense of connection and a greater sense of community. We've talked about this on the program before. What engagement center is CASE a part of, and what's that like, Annika?
So CASE is a part of South Neighborhood, and our engagement center is in Holden. So that's a resource, a math learning center. They can go and get writing help, economics. If they need freshman year counseling, they can all go there, get all their problems solved.
But there's a deliberate effort made to connect everybody in the South.
Yes.
Sorry, how'd you refer to it?
South Neighborhood.
South Neighborhood to Holden.
Yes.
And to say, hey, you don't have to traipse to Acres. You don't have to go to Mayo. You don't have to go to Student Services. What you need is there.
Yeah, one of the things about the engagement centers that I think is really neat, it attracted me to come and work here at Michigan State, is that it really is an attempt to make this campus smaller and more manageable for students to be successful. I think we're all interested in helping students succeed and matriculate from this institution. The engagement centers do that.
Is there a point at which you just breathe a little sigh of relief? At the end of this weekend, do you breathe any kind of sigh of relief? Hey, the elevators worked, you know.
It's really probably after Labor Day that I start to breathe a little bit more normally.
Everybody is more or less where they belong. Everything more or less is working. I understand. We've been talking about move-in weekend coming up here at Michigan State. The fall semester begins next week. Ray Gasser is the interim director for Residence Education and Housing Services. Also, good luck to Annika Hart, an RA, an engineering major, resident assistant at Michigan State. You never forget your resident assistant.
I believe that. Thank you.
That's a John Rubishin was mine in Emmons Hall, 1971. I'll never forget him. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It is a Live Music Friday here on WKAR's Current State. Brendan Doherty joins us today. We've heard Brendan a couple of times already. Let's hear a track called everything I needed.
See the dust pile on the mantle, how the years have made it small. Once it stood like cliffs of moher, where I'd play for hours, and there was a toy that had fallen and was bleeding. The cavalry came and parachuted to where they are needed. It held treasures high above me, precious things that I could use. So I'd go and climb it boldly, and just before I'd fall, you would arrive. And in your arms, oh what a feeling. Yeah, there was a time you had everything I needed. That was 20 years ago, and I've grown a lot since then. And now I do these things for you, and I'll be there. I'll be there till the end. Now that I have kids to care for, I see the sacrifice you've made. When they play and ask for stories, I tell them of this time that there was a toy who had fallen and was bleeding. The cavalry came and parachuted to where they are needed. Yeah, there was a time you had everything I needed.
Very, very nice. Brendan Doherty here on Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. I listened to a radio interview you did earlier this month in on your Facebook page, done back in your hometown radio
yes.
station in Waterford, Ireland, and you told the story of that song.
Yes.
Share that with us now.
It's about so back in my home place, we have this mantelpiece that my dad built, and there's lots of stories around it. But briefly,
a fireplace,
yeah.
Okay.
And so it's all stone and that, and he built the fireplace part of it, and my uncle was a cabinet maker, so he made the mantelpiece. And as a kid, I guess I was maybe five or that, I used to think it was huge, and it used to look like a cliff to me. So, and I had these toy soldiers that I guess you may remember, and I guess younger listeners
well,
will.
Well, I played with them too, sure.
Yeah, know them from Toy Story and that. And anyway, mine were paratroopers, so they had the parachute, and I was able to throw them off the mantelpiece and they glide down to the bottom.
And,
perfect. And it occurred to me last year when I was back home that how small it looks now. You know,
oh,
I used to think it was huge.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
I and, think everybody goes through that.
Yeah, and a funny story, when we launched the CD in Ireland, we had a really nice launch party, and my mum came, and I told the story about it, you know, and I played the song to her at home. She hadn't heard it, so I played it to her a few days before the launch party because I didn't want to give her a shock, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was nervous, you know, because you never know how someone would respond to a song that's about them. And at the end of it, she paused for a minute, and then she said, "Wow, was there dust on the mantelpiece then too?"
That's a line in the song.
Yeah. It's,
oh, okay.
It's a selective hearing. Okay. You know?
Well, it's tempting to assume that the new CD is called "Feels Like Home." It's tempting to assume that it's about East Lansing, I guess, because you haven't been in East Lansing too awful long. Does East Lansing feel like home? And is that what this is about, or is
no.
it about Ireland? It's I
no,
imagine
it's about I guess it could be about anywhere that feels like home to you. Yeah. But it's about that feeling of home. I wrote it when we were in Qatar, but it's a little idea that had been in my mind for a long time. And my ancestors come from Donegal. So the first time I visited Donegal, I got this overwhelming feeling of being at home, which I couldn't explain. I actually had to stop driving and try and figure out. I got very emotional. And I couldn't understand my connection to this landscape. And then I drove into a local town and Doherty was on everything. It was Doherty's pub and there was buses going past me with my name on it. And I couldn't. It was unbelievable. Wow. Amazing experience.
You've had a couple of interesting moves here. And you mm-hmm. talked about this the last time you were on. You moved to East Lansing from?
From Qatar.
Qatar.
Yeah.
Remind our listeners how you ended up in the Middle East in the first place.
Well, myself and Kathleen, my wife, who works at the Broad. She's
right.
a curator at the Broad.
Right.
Kathleen was made an offer for a job with Virginia Commonwealth University Qatar campus. And we always had this thing that we had built our home in Ireland and we were very well established there, but we always had this little hankering, I guess, in us to travel. And, you know, that this is not just it. There must be more
yeah.
than just, you know, paying the bank for our house here yeah. and so on. So, we felt that that it would be really good to travel. And then this offer came along. We thought, well, caution to the wind, let's give it a go.
How long were you there?
3 years.
Did it ever feel like home?
No.
Okay.
But it was very good to us.
It's hard to visualize a thriving Irish music community in Qatar, or am I wrong?
Funnily enough, I mean, I hit it at a lucky time. The GAA, the Gaelic Athletic Association, are very strong there, believe it or not.
And, really?
Yeah, and I think I hit it at a lucky time because it's very transient. So people are coming and going, and they all do maybe between 3 and 5 years, and then they go on somewhere else. So we hit it at a lucky time when the first year I played hardly any music. But the second year, I found some players that, you know, were maybe they were teachers and they were doing different things.
Okay.
And they were also looking for people. So we wound up putting a really nice trad session together. And in the end, I had a band and we used to play twice a week in the Ritz-Carlton, which was really fun.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Brendan Doherty's our musical guest here on Live Music Friday. Brendan's new CD is called Feels Like Home. This was produced in Nashville, and you've commented that this CD, how many CDs does this make?
This is just the second one for me, the second major one, if you like.
And you've commented this has a more stripped down feel,
yes.
I think, to compared to your first.
Yeah.
How so? Fewer instruments? What?
Yes, and very much focused on the vocal this time. It's two guitars and violin, essentially. So the producer is playing one guitar, I'm playing the other, and then we have Andrea Zahn, the name wouldn't necessarily jump out at you, but she was James Taylor's fiddle player and harmony singer, and she's a friend of the producer, Tom, so she very graciously agreed to come in and has played some amazing violin for us, and then we have Jeff Taylor on accordion, who plays with Vince Gill and people like that, so...
Well, it's really nice. The effect of a solo violin on a lot of James Taylor cuts that I've listened to it's a beautiful touch. She's the player.
She's the player.
Yeah.
So, and I love her feel, and, you know, she was so relaxed, and it was wonderful to work with her.
Well, let's hear the title cut here. We've talked a lot about home, which for Brendan Doherty is Waterford, Ireland. Here's the title track from his latest CD, Feels Like Home.
Feel it all around me and taste it in the air from way down deep inside me. I know that it's just there, the sunlight on a flower, whisper in the trees,
echo through the valley. Wherever I may be, it feels like home. Feels like home. Feels like home to me. I see it in a smile across a crowded room. I hear it in a voice that sings an ancient tune. I see it in the young and hear it in the old. I see it in your eyes, treasure to behold. It feels like home. Feels like home. Feels like home to me. Day, a week, a month, a year, a thousand miles or more. One day I will return to you and tap that old front door. It feels like home. Feels like home. Feels like home. Feels like home to me.
Brendan Doherty on Live Music Friday here on WKAR's Current State, the title track from his new CD, Feels Like Home. We're going to hear Brendan play here again briefly to play us out of the show here, but I do want to talk about you're here in East Lansing. When and where might people have a chance to see you perform in the near future?
We're working on some dates at the moment. I don't have anything concrete yet.
Okay.
I really wanted to do this unlike the other albums I've done and the other singles I've released, where everything was planned and had a big media campaign. And unlike that, this time I've gone very softly. It was more about getting the album right. I wanted it to be right. And now that that's done, I did a soft launch at home. And so we do plan to do a launch. I just have to figure out the fine details of it, and there will be more to come.
There has been a launch in Ireland, though, correct?
Yes.
And you're there every summer, told me.
Yeah, we go back every summer.
There was a performance, I guess, a show back home. Tell us about that show.
I wanted to do, as I said, a soft launch. So it wasn't a big theater thing. It was a small listening room, about 50 people. Mainly friends and family, and it was a really special night, and I wanted to do that, you know, so that they felt included in the whole project. And to me, obviously, the album is Feels Like Home, and it's about home, so it made sense for me to start there. And I felt, you know, that's one of the boxes ticked, if you like, and now I can kind of bring it out to the rest of the world.
It's really attractive package.
Oh, thank you.
This will jump right out at you when you see it.
Thank you.
Brendan Doherty's Feels Like Home. Where can people get the CD? How?
At the moment, by contacting me through the Facebook page, which is Brendan Doherty Music. And also I have an email, it's brendandohertymusic@gmail.com. And there's a website which is a little bit long-winded. It's TaylorMade Irish Music Tours. And the album's available there.
Okay.
.com, I should say. It will be online. I'm just holding off a little bit, but it will be available on iTunes and Spotify and so all these other sites.
Okay.
In the next, probably in about a month's time.
All right. Taking time to get it right. Brendan Doherty, the new CD, his second, is called Feels Like Home, and he calls East Lansing home. We'll have Brendan play us out here in just a minute after I remind you that on Monday's current state, the Flint Institute of Art is kicking off its 2016-17 Friends of the Modern Art film series. We'll find out more about the series and get a preview of some of the selected films with Associate Curator of Film, Ed Bradley. Also, move over baseball. Here comes college football, just a week to go before the Spartans' home opener against Furman out of Greenville, South Carolina. Al Martin joins us from Current Sports for a preview of MSU's prospects this season. Been a pleasure to have you, Brendan. Thanks. You're welcome here anytime. Enjoyed it an awful lot. We'll let Brendan play us out. Have a great weekend.
I don't know if you can see the changes that have come over me. Last few days I've been afraid that I might drift away. I've been telling stories and singing songs that make me think about where I've come from, and that's the reason why I feel so far away today. But let me tell you that I love you. Think about you all the time. Caledonia, you're calling me, and I'm going home. And if I should become a stranger, know that it would make me more than sad. Caledonia's been everything I've ever had. I have moved and I've kept on moving, proved the points that needed proving. I've lost a friend.